Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. I'm sure many of you are familiar with how important vitamin D is for our overall health and well-being, but did you know that sunshine and fortified foods are not enough to get the job done? Almost all Americans, yes, that's like all of us, are failing to consume just 400 IUs of vitamin D each day. And half of all adults in America are clinically vitamin D insufficient. Truly staggering statistics when you take into account just how important vitamin D is to muscle, bone, immune, and whole body health. So we developed Vitamin D3 Potency Plus because we wanted to bring to you a truly high quality, high dose, and highly absorbable vitamin D3 supplement with 5,000 IUs of organic algal vitamin D3, which our bodies prefer to D2, and a trio of organic oils to maximize absorption. We've really cracked the code to provide you with the latest in vitamin D3 technology. Just one gel cap a day will help you achieve optimal vitamin D levels for life. So visit mybuddygreen.com/D3pod, P-O-D, and use the code D3pod to save 25% off your order of vitamin D3 Potency Plus. Autoimmune diseases are increasingly common, affecting an estimated 23.5 million people in the U.S., 80% of whom are women. If you're one of the millions who struggle with an autoimmune condition, it's important to identify your specific triggers. But there's one giant cause globally renowned thought leader, Dr. Sarah Gottfried, says we're all overlooking: trauma. Sarah is a powerhouse, a Harvard and MIT trained integrative medicine doctor and four-time New York Times bestselling author who has been part of the MBG ecosystem for years and a dear friend of Colleen and I. I am so excited to have her back on the show to discuss her new amazing book, The Autoimmune Cure, which covers the emotional triggers for autoimmune disease, how to assess your level of trauma, and a plan of action to help your body heal. So how is medicine falling short when it comes to autoimmune disease? Big question.
Let me count the ways, Jason. You know, there's a number of conditions where I think people just feel like they are struggling. And in the case of autoimmune disease, folks typically take 4 to 7 years to get a correct diagnosis. They see 4 to 6 physicians. And that alone, I think, indicates how modern medicine is failing people with autoimmune disease. There's also the issue of something we think about a lot in functional medicine, which is that you don't suddenly flip a switch and develop autoimmune disease, whether that's rheumatoid arthritis or celiac or type 1 diabetes or lupus. What happens is that there's typically 7 to 10 years of kind of these early, more subtle signs that you're heading toward autoimmune disease. And once again, those fly below the radar of most clinicians in conventional medicine. So right now we've got about 25 million people with autoimmune disease. We've got a much greater number of people with autoimmunity who haven't had a diagnosis yet of autoimmune disease. And we're just not treating it in the right way. We tend to chase it with immune suppression, and we diagnose it too late. So those are some of the ways that I can think of off the top of my head. But it's an example of something that affects women more than men. It is especially common for women who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And this is the population that is not adequately served by mainstream medicine. So we've got to change that.
So what are some of the subtle signs?
Well, part of what's tricky with the symptoms is that they're nonspecific. So that means fatigue, joint pain, muscle pain, you know, noticing that you're just not as restored as you once were. You sleep maybe 7 or 8 hours at night, and you wake up in the morning and you're just not feeling as full of life as you usually do. It can be skin changes like with psoriasis. It can be gut symptoms, like with inflammatory bowel disease. And my focus, you know, I'm not a rheumatologist. I'm not someone who is treating once someone has fully established disease. I'm in more of a precision medicine role where I try to prevent the course of illness. And I work with people once they have a disease to address the gut, to address diet, to address some of these other factors that contribute to autoimmune disease. And so these early subtle symptoms are kind of vague indicators of something not quite being right.
And what have you learned within your own personal experience as it relates to autoimmune? And I think more specifically, trauma. We tend to think of autoimmune as we go right to intake. What are we putting in our body? Is it grains? Is it sugar? Is it all the other, you know, bad guys, so to speak? But we tend not to talk about the emotional, mental, and spiritual components. What have you learned in your personal experience there?
Well, I think these are really important indicators. And yeah, you know, I trained in the conventional medicine system. So I was taught with autoimmune disease that you look for certain things that Alessio Fasano at Massachusetts General Hospital talks about. You look for genetic predisposition. You look for increased intestinal permeability or leaky gut. And then you look for a trigger. So all three have to be present to develop autoimmune disease. And what folks often don't understand is that those triggers can often be emotional or spiritual. They can be toxic stress. Certainly, it can be a traumatic experience. But this is one of those places where we have this emerging understanding of trauma. And I feel like now that we've made it through the pandemic, there's a way in which almost none of us are not touched by trauma of one type or another. So whether that's small T trauma, you know, sort of the difficulties of daily life, or the capital T trauma, the big T trauma, which are the things that kind of everyone agrees is traumatic, you know, losing a parent, especially during COVID, being in a near fatal car accident. And so one of the things we are understanding now is that the type of trauma matters less than the way that it lives on in your body. So what I see, to get back to your question, what I see in my medical practice is that there are so many folks who have this level of dysregulation that's occurring in their body. They may not have a diagnosis associated with it, but there's something that's just making them dysregulated. And that's where I get really interested, you know, sort of that interface of dysregulation, how we can pick it up as early as possible, and how we can prevent that dysregulation from leading to a disease. So that's what I'm seeing in my practice. And, you know, when we talk about dysregulation, what do I mean by that? I mean blood sugar dysregulation. You know, I've got a G7 on because I've got a fair amount of dysregulation myself. Nervous system dysregulation, you know, having difficulty with vagal tone and with having a healthy heart rate variability. I think of the networks of the body, Jason, and what tends to get the most dysregulated. And you can think of it as the PINE system, which stands for psychoimmunoneuroendocrine system. So all of those aspects of your PINE system are really designed to help you feel fabulous, you know, kind of brimming with energy. But there are ways that the signature of trauma, the signature of toxic stress can lead to these dysregulations and lead to autoimmunity. Not in everyone who's got toxic stress or trauma, but what I saw in my practice was that a significant number of people with autoimmune disease have a history of toxic stress and trauma.
So in researching the book, which is amazing, I'll hold it up, The Autoimmune Cure, for those watching on YouTube or listening, definitely go buy it. What studies did you come across which really led you to take a deeper look in the role of trauma and some of these triggers that the Western community and in some regard, the holistic community really weren't paying attention to?
Yeah, the studies that stood out the most to me were first how common trauma is. So, you know, there's sort of two lines of inquiry here. There's the autoimmune piece, and then there's the trauma piece, and then the ways in which they overlap. So when I was looking at trauma, I was surprised to see how common it is. And we've known this for 20 plus years. So some of the biggest initial studies that were done were carried out by the Centers for Disease Control together with Kaiser Permanente. Those were initially published in 1998. And they found from looking at Kaiser Permanente members, so mostly middle class, upper middle class folks with healthcare coverage in that particular population, somewhere around 50 to 60% of people had a history of significant trauma before age 18. And that's also known as adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. And since that time, the studies show that the higher your ACE score, that is associated with more than 45 different chronic diseases, not just mental health. I mean, you might think, of course, that's going to increase your risk of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety. But we're talking about physical health issues too. Much greater risk of diabetes, more problems with blood sugar, more problems with autoimmune disease, more problems with cardiovascular disease. So that's one body of literature that I think is really important. Another one that really got my attention is a study that was done by NHANES. It's just a national survey where they looked at the number of people in the US with anti-nuclear antibodies that are positive. So these are B cells in your immune system start to attack your own tissue, and they attack the nucleus of your cells. That's what an anti-nuclear antibody is. And what's been shown over time is that over the past 20 plus years, the rate of positive anti-nuclear antibodies has increased significantly. So there's something about the way that we're living that is increasing our attack of our own body.
And so if someone's listening and they're saying, you know what, a lot of this is resonating, but how do I assess if my early onset autoimmune condition or full-on autoimmune is diet or something deeper emotionally, or both? How does one begin that process?
Well, this is where I think working with a collaborative clinician can be so helpful. And certainly functional medicine clinicians are trained to look at autoimmune disease in this way, to look at, you know, kind of this multifactorial systems-based approach where we're not just looking at your immune system in isolation. We're looking at the much bigger picture of how all of these systems work together. So I would say finding a collaborative clinician is really critical. And then also having a dose of skepticism. So I'm thinking of one of my cases in particular, a woman in her early 40s. She probably is a huge fan of MindBody Green because she's a yoga teacher. I met her through a yoga studio that she owns. And she went through this terrible trauma of discovering that her husband was having an affair with her best friend. So she went through this really difficult trauma. And a few months later, she started to notice elbow pain and swelling and stiffness, and some knee pain and swelling and stiffness. And she ran a panel of tests with her primary care doctor. She had positive rheumatoid factor, which is associated with rheumatoid arthritis. She then got sent to a rheumatologist who said, oh yes, you definitely have rheumatoid arthritis. Here's a prescription. Good luck with that. See you in 6 months. So that's kind of the standard issue approach. And for someone who is facing some symptoms and they're not sure whether this is related to autoimmune disease, I would say work with a collaborative clinician. Get my book because I think it'll give you a great start in terms of the food-based approach that's been shown to be the most helpful, which is a very particular elimination diet. And then, you know, in some ways, it's kind of like peeling an onion. I would say food first as an approach to some of the symptoms you might be facing. And then as you peel the onion, you might discover that you feel better with an elimination diet for some period of time, maybe 2 weeks or 30 days. And then you start to backslide a little. And that's a situation where I think we have to widen the aperture and we have to start thinking about things like trauma, like toxic stress, relationships, sleep, exercise, you know, the way that you're living your life.
You know, if I think about all the weird health things I've had in my life, I don't have autoimmune, but whenever I've had something come up, without question, there's been something going on emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And something I've found is whatever's been quote unquote weak in my system, that's where the issue was. So the early days, part of the founding story of Mind Body Green, it was my lower back. My lower back was the weak spot. And my lower back got stronger. And then there was a period years later, another big part of my evolution, I struggled with parasites and my stomach. Like whenever I was stressed, or it would manifest in my gut. And then right now I'm pretty good. Now I'm just tired because our 4.5-year-old was having a nightmare. And I watched the Super Bowl last night for, you know, more the 4.5-year-old having a nightmare. So what do you think about this bigger idea of people having areas of weakness in their body and how issues can manifest themselves triggered by stress or trauma or anything?
So glad that you're raising the question in this way, Jason, because I think what we're talking about here is we all have areas of vulnerability. We all have them. So your low back, this episode that you had with parasites, those are really common areas of vulnerability. And when we frame our symptoms the way that I feel like you frame them, which is as messages, maybe even divine messages from the body, when you frame it that way and you decode it and you try to, you know, pull back the layers of what is it that your body is trying to tell you, it completely changes the way that you approach healthcare. It changes the way that you approach your body. And too often we do what I was trained to do in mainstream medicine, which is to say, okay, you've got low back pain, Jason. Let's start some ibuprofen. Take ibuprofen. And, you know, maybe you've got a primary care doctor who says, do these back strengthening exercises. You were a basketball player, so you were super fit. But, you know, maybe there's some aspect of your core that needs to be addressed, or some way that you're holding your body that needs to be decoded. And then the gut is such a critical indicator. You know, I think of the gut sort of together with the immune system, but it's probably the area of vulnerability that I see the most commonly, because of the way that we eat, the way that we stress. You know, I've got like a pretty healthy diet, but I've gone in and out of problems with my gut health, which has affected my immune system, related to a course of antibiotics when I had prophylactic mastectomies, related to being exposed to glyphosate and getting too much of it. You know, there's lots of ways in which we might have some vulnerability, and then our environment together with that vulnerability puts us at much greater risk and then puts us kind of over the edge in terms of signs and symptoms.
Yes. And what also comes to mind, Jason Karp, who's a friend, he's the founder of Hue Chocolate, which we love, and the Human Co. He's on the board of True Food Kitchen. We've had him on the show, it was years ago. And he is, quote unquote, really hardcore, as in terms of diet. He suffered from debilitating autoimmune, had something, I forget the name of the condition, but it was super rare. And he essentially was going blind, like in his 20s, like no one could figure it out. It was essentially autoimmune, and diet essentially and lifestyle cured the condition. He's in like a medical book somewhere. Like that's how serious this was. And I'll never forget when we spoke about this on the podcast. We'll link to it in the show notes. You know, this is someone who's very strict, very hardcore about his diet. And then would, of course, caveat. And then, you know, you go on vacation. And when you go on vacation, you live a little, whether it's a week or 2 weeks, you kind of eat whatever and you're fine. And I think that the larger point he was making too, for someone even very sensitive, who clearly had something very serious going on with his microbiome, with his gut health, that was triggering this horrible autoimmune response. You know, vacation came up, kind of didn't matter. On the beach, feet in the sand, having maybe a drink, having a margarita, no worries, all good. And I think this is directly related to stress, the little T, the big T, and I think, you know, maybe it's not the best way to paraphrase, but I think diet maybe loads the gun, so to speak, and stress pulls the trigger, or vice versa.
That's beautifully stated. And I see that all the time. I see patients who, you know, maybe they didn't have an optimal food plan and then they optimize their food plan. But when they address toxic stress, when they, as you said, go on vacation and have sort of this much more expansive feeling, it just makes the network of the body work differently. And it's, you know, we don't have randomized trials showing that that's what solves autoimmunity, but maybe we should.
Well, and I think, you know, you've been in this space for quite some time. We've known you for a while. We know a lot of the same people. And there are definitely some people, no names, who probably have the cleanest diets in the world, but they're not happy. And they're always having issues. And they're like, their diet is so dialed into a T, I aspire to eat like them someday. And they still have tons of issues. And it kind of makes you scratch your head and think, like, what's really going on here?
For sure. You know, some people have a shorter leash than others. That's true when it comes to food. You know, there's some people who can liberalize their food plan and get away with it. There are people who have to be really strict, like the way that you described, Jason, and then they go on vacation and they actually do just fine, even with a more liberalized diet. And then there are people who, once they sort of get all these pieces into place, you know, they get a food plan that allows them to live, but still feels like it's addressing some of these ways that the body can attack itself. And there are food-based things that can do that and accelerate that. Once they dial in, you know, the role of love and purpose and meaning, once they dial in the right amount of sleep for them, and maybe they even track it, which is what I do with my clients, once they get the exercise dialed in, it really makes a difference. And it's, yeah, when I think about the folks that you're describing, I think there's like this grasping and tension associated with the way that they're eating that is still triggering the PINE network, if you know what I mean.
Well, you know, it's this idea. So I'm a huge believer in elimination diets. And I think it's so powerful because if done correctly, you're identifying triggers. And I think this is the critical stage. The critical thing you need to do is you identify the trigger and then you remove that trigger. But in the process of doing an elimination diet, you're removing a lot of stuff. The key is you got to like add some stuff back in. You just don't remove everything. Like you find the triggers, you remove the triggers, like, and you got to like kind of add back the rest. And I think a lot of people in our world fall into like, they just eliminate everything. And then you should try to work it back in and see the response. So like dairy, for example, the classic thing is, you know, you remove dairy, it makes a difference. And but like maybe a month later, you should, hey, maybe I'll have a little grass-fed dairy if that makes a difference. Or maybe it's the Greek yogurt instead of the whatever it might be, just to see what the response is versus just like, I'm done for life. And I just remove like a pretty massive category. And some people have to, but like gotta edit.
Yeah, you gotta edit. And it's, yeah, I mean, the whole idea with an elimination diet, and I agree with you. What I love about the elimination diet is it's free. Like there's no cost, but a lot of people don't realize it's the elimination provocation diet. And so you have to then provoke, and you want to do it really slowly. You know, I think of the recent Super Bowl and how my clients have been sending me their food plans, and they have like these beautiful, enviable food plans. And then the Super Bowl hits and they have pizza and KFC and a couple glasses of wine, maybe a beer. And that's kind of a setup for a hot mess. So yes, when it comes to the elimination diet, you've got to do the elimination typically for 30 to 90 days. Then you do the provocation. You want to do it correctly. And you don't want to develop orthorexia. You don't want to be restricting so much that you're missing out on key nutrients.
Coming back to the bigger point around the connection between the trauma and the triggers and diet, I'm curious, what have you learned from your personal experience that's like really shaped your view over the course of your career, which led you to this book, and how it's a little bit more complex than just diet?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would say I've written a few books.
Just a few. I'm like, you're a prolific best-selling author. Don't sell yourself short. Everything you touch turns to gold. So I've written a few books.
My books trace the challenges that I faced. The first thing I experienced in my mid-30s was my hormones were just an absolute mess. And so that got me to look at the top 7 hormone imbalances that women face and to come up with protocols that really work to solve them. And I had almost every single one of them. So what have I learned? What I've learned is that you can dial in your food, you can dial in your exercise, your sleep, your mindset, your purpose, meaning having beautiful love relationships in your life. But if there's a way that toxic stress is still running the show for you, it sets you up for dysregulation, some people more than others. So I learned about myself. Here's what I learned. And this was with my psychedelic assisted therapist. So this might start to get a little more juicy because psychedelics are one of the ways that we can.
So, but I'm going to make an important distinction here. You said psychedelic assisted therapist. You didn't just, you know, take a flight to Tulum and grab a shaman at the cab state at the nearest cab and say, take me to the promised land. Difference.
That's right. Yeah. So I really believe in psychedelic assisted therapy. I think that's the way that we should be framing, you know, the pending approval of MDMA by the FDA, as well as use of other psychedelics like psilocybin and ketamine. But I had this experience with my psychedelic assisted therapist that I worked with for a couple of years, where we discovered that I'm highly sensitive. And that may not sound so surprising, but to be in my 50s and to realize, oh my gosh, the reason why I'm so overstimulated all the time is that I'm so sensitive to my environment. And this therapist said to me, I was talking about something about like, oh, there's so much noise in our house and I have to wear earplugs or to get any work done. And I have to like go up to my bedroom and like hide out in the den and blah, blah, blah. And he said, it sounds like you might be a highly sensitive person. I was like, I've heard of that. I don't, whatever. He said, no, let's go through the questionnaire.
I wouldn't have guessed that. You seem like you're pretty big. You got a pretty big personal brand. I think you have thick skin to put yourself out there like you do.
You would think so. But 20% of the population is highly sensitive. And we live in a world that is made of people who are not highly sensitive. So the world is really designed for folks who don't have the kind of sensitivity that I'm describing. So learning that was really powerful, Jason, because it got me to, you know, look at some of the patterns in my life, whether it's the way that I travel or the way that I get together with my daughters and, you know, sort of celebrate them, the way that I socialize. It's really changed so much.
Walk me through. I'm curious, as it relates to socialization, travel, and kids. We have 2 daughters, we socialize, and we also travel. So I'm very curious how that changed for you in those 3 areas.
Yeah. Well, I just went on this trip to Japan, and I'll give you some example kind of travel and socializing. So the days that we would all go out for dinner, and we'd have these like beautiful 3-hour meals at a Japanese restaurant, those were really hard for me. So I'm trying to manage the food. I'm trying to manage, you know, the conversation. I drink very little, so I'm really careful about that. But the sake is flowing and the Japanese whiskey is flowing. And the way that I perform or the way that I feel in that context is very different than the way I felt when we had a meal at our house with the same number of people, with like, you know, 10 people. But for me, it's night and day because there's less stimulation that I have to manage. So that's one example. You know, in terms of socializing, I'm not saying, you know, I have to stay home and only meet with a certain number of people, but it makes a big difference for me to manage my environment really carefully. And then with my daughters, what was really surprising to me is that when I came home in that psychedelic assisted therapy session And I was so gung-ho about helping people understand if they're highly sensitive. I had both of my daughters take the quiz, and we were really surprised by their results. And it helped make sense of some of the challenges that they have, you know, in college and during the pandemic. And now with a new job, one of them has a job in San Francisco. So it's helped me understand them in a way that I think is really fruitful and allows them, you know, at a much earlier stage than me, since I learned when I was in my 50s, it allows them to then architect their environment in a way that really supports their greatest success. And let me say one other quick thing about it. And this is from my psychedelic assisted therapist. He also is highly sensitive. And he says the most beautiful thing. He says, you know, so many people who are highly sensitive get pathologized. So I grew up being told all the time that I was too intense. I was too sensitive. Don't take things so personally, Sarah. And, you know, I heard that over and over and over again. And so my skin did get a little bit thicker, but there's a way that when you understand this about yourself, the level of sensitivity you have to your environment, it allows you to be like an orchid that, given the right conditions, blooms and blooms and blooms and blooms. Whereas people who are less sensitive are more like, you know, there's kind of three different categories. There's the dandelion that kind of thrives anywhere, doesn't matter what sort of environment you put them in. And then there's the tulips that are kind of halfway in between. But knowing this about myself has really made huge changes. And I think it's got important consequences when it comes to your health and how you become dysregulated, how easily or how difficult it is for you to become dysregulated. So how's this landing with you, Jason?
It's landing. And I think about socialization, something I love getting together with like-minded folks. Like this weekend, JJ Virgin, our mutual friend, was in town. So we had Colleen and I had dinner with JJ and her husband, Tim, and then Todd from Dry Farm Wines and his partner, Cameron. And we all went out and like we all had a couple drinks and had sushi, except it was Uchi in Miami, not Japan. You'll have to join us when you come to Miami. It's amazing. We all had some drinks. Of course, it's Dry Farm Wine. So, you know, less alcohol, all good. And it was amazing, but I can't do that like 3 or 4 days a week. Like, it was amazing. I wouldn't have traded everything. We were joking the next morning, like, all of our Aura and Whoop scores are subpar, but totally worth it. Totally worth it. But I can't do it. I can't do that 3 or 4 times a week. I could do that, you know, once a week at best. And I think awareness is just understanding your preferred social settings, understanding, you know, how sensitive you truly are. And I'm going to come back to what got you there. So this was MDMA assisted therapy. Why MDMA specifically and not ketamine or psilocybin? Why MDMA for you?
MDMA because I wanted to address trauma. I wanted to resolve trauma utterly in my system and get to a place where I could be fully present for my life without having trauma still drive some of my behavior. So I feel that MDMA is the most proven to have that effect. So we now have 2 phase 3 randomized trials showing that 2 to 3 courses, doses of MDMA assisted therapy can resolve the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder in somewhere around 67 to 71% of people.
Wow.
And that's with moderate post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's also with severe post-traumatic stress disorder. So the first randomized trial in 2021 that was published showed that. And so my sense is that there are many healing states of consciousness that can help you regulate your system and help you, you know, reduce the triggering effects of toxic stress. Certainly breath work. One of the things I picked up over the last few years is holotropic breath work. Certainly love creates a healing state of consciousness, gratitude. But when you look at the evidence, there's nothing quite as effective as MDMA-assisted therapy. So my sense from the literature is that you should keep giving MDMA-assisted therapy until you resolve trauma. And that's when you move on to some of the other medications, at least for someone who's got the experience of trauma. I'm also someone who administers ketamine. So I've got a certification in psychedelic medicine. And ketamine, we think of more as it's a dissociative. It's not a classic psychedelic. Neither, you know, MDMA also isn't a classic psychedelic. But ketamine is mostly for treatment-resistant depression. There's also some newer data looking at it for disordered eating, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So there's lots of new indications for ketamine. But ketamine is also used off-label for these purposes, whereas MDMA is Schedule I. So it's harder to get, although we expect it's going to become widely available once it's FDA approved.
So could you paint a picture of what an MDMA treatment session looks like for someone potentially interesting? Because I think many people, when they hear psychedelics, they think of, oh God, I'm going to hallucinate, or I'm going to try not into that. Don't want to, you know, I think that's more psilocybin, if you will. Although I think that's changed versus, you know, for me, what that looked like in college and my fraternity versus like what that looks like today. So walk us through, what does MDMA treatment look like for somebody? And then what does ketamine treatment look like for somebody? Paint that picture for us.
So this is what I wanted to write about in this book. And we really felt like talking about psychedelics in the context of a medical condition that people really struggle with and suffer from was important. So to walk you through an MDMA-assisted therapy session, what I was trained to do through MAPS is to do an intake. You see if there's any contraindications to getting MDMA-assisted therapy. And right now, the way that you get it is through research studies. So that's above ground. That's what I can talk about as a licensed physician. And then, of course, there are folks that work below ground.
We're above ground here.
We're above ground. Yeah. So the MAPS training is that you go through this intake process. Usually you do a total of 3 appointments before a journey. And so intake, and then usually 2 prep sessions where you talk about your intentions, you talk about the, you know, the set and the setting, which are really important for getting into a healing state of consciousness. And then MDMA typically lasts for somewhere around 6 hours for most people who take it. It's an empathogen, so it gets you, it just fills you with love. It fills you with connection. It allows you to think back for some of your memories and to do it without the fear response that often kicks in, or sort of that habitual response. And so when I first did MDMA assisted therapy, it was when I had a falling out with one of my relatives, and I really wanted to do everything possible to clean up my side of the street. And so that's what got me motivated to enter into that relationship with my psychedelic assisted therapist. So back to the structure, you've got 3 appointments, you've got the journey, and then typically you've got 3 integration appointments afterwards. So that includes the meaning making from the experience that you had. MDMA causes the sudden release of epinephrine, dopamine, norepinephrine. And so this experience of taking an empathogen just allows you to really shift the matrix of your body and orient toward love. So it lasts for about 6 hours. Integration allows it to, you know, sort of continue to mend and heal in your body. When I do MDMA assisted therapy now, I feel the effects much longer than 6 hours. I feel the effects more like 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow. And you're not hallucinating, to be clear.
There's no hallucinating. Yeah, with MDMA, it tends to be classified together with classic psychedelics because it's going to be the first medication to be FDA approved, but it acts by a different mechanism. So classic psychedelics, the things that make you hallucinate, act through the serotonin HT2A receptor, and that includes psilocybin, LSD, DMT, 5-MeO-DMT. So you're not hallucinating. Now with ketamine, ketamine's really interesting. I started using ketamine clinically about 30 years ago. I used it starting in my internship and in residency. We would use it when we were doing cesarean sections, you know, especially on women who needed an urgent or emergent cesarean section. And there wasn't time for like an epidural or a spinal. And so with ketamine, what we're doing is shifting from that dose that's used for anesthesia to about a tenth of that dose that we use for treatment-resistant depression or what I like to think of as stuckness. But we've got a similar sort of structure where there's typically an intake. You know, we're checking blood pressure. We're seeing if there's any contraindications to taking it. We're seeing if someone is a good fit. We're then doing the prep sessions where we're talking about intention and, you know, kind of the flight instructions. Then there's the journey itself. And with ketamine, it's shorter. So it's typically somewhere around 60 to 90 minutes, depending on the way that you take it. So you can take it intramuscularly, intravenously, sublingually. There's even a nasal spray that's FDA approved for treatment-resistant depression. And then once again, you've got typically integration sessions afterwards. And I like to do 2 to 3 integration sessions after ketamine. And then there are some people who've got treatment-resistant depression who use ketamine once a week for 6 sessions or more. So there's a number of different protocols out there, but that reflects my experience.
And you said MDMA, you believe that's going to be classified as a FDA-approved drug soon.
That's right. So Rick Doblin, the head of MAPS, founder of MAPS, he's been working decades on this particular project. And so he's the one that I look to for the latest update, and he really thinks 2024 is when this is going to happen. So yeah, it's really exciting. And, you know, part of the problem here, if we go back to kind of the failure of conventional medicine, when you look at people who've got post-traumatic stress disorder, or what I see more often, which is partial PTSD or sub-threshold PTSD, they often get sent to talk therapy, sometimes for decades. They sometimes get treated with a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor together with the talk therapy. Occasionally, they'll get trauma-informed therapy or trauma-informed care, but the efficacy is so low. It's somewhere around 30%. And I feel like if I were told when I was in my 20s that talk therapy had an efficacy of 30% for helping me resolve my trauma, I don't know that I would have done it. So to see these other treatments like MDMA-assisted therapy have more than double the efficacy, there's nothing like it.
To stay on that one, do you believe the 30% to be, I consider that number to be low because of the quality of the therapist or the quality of the treatment or both?
There are certain factors that you try to control for when you look at efficacy. And so the quality of the therapist, generally what is done is that you get, you know, like in the MDMA trials, there's 2 couples that do the therapy and train people in how to do the therapy. So it's a particular type of therapy with psychedelics where it's much more about accessing your innate healing capacity and less about kind of this top-down approach. So is it the quality of the therapist? Is it the quality of the therapy? We don't really know. What we know is that doesn't seem to be working, at least not.
What do you think? I'm curious. What does your gut say? I'll tell you my answer after you.
Okay. I think it's both.
I think it's both. But I also think I kind of lean heavier towards therapists because I think we've seen this in medicine. You know, so many people have come to Mind Body Green or come to you because they've had bad experiences with practitioners. And so it's a little bit of the system. And I think it's a little bit of the output of that system, which can often be bad practitioners. And where I want to segue from there is, you know, we've talked a lot about the failures of Western. I would also say the holistic community has not been perfect here as well. Like, what do you think some of the mistakes our own community has made here?
I really appreciate this question. And this is where I get to point the finger at myself and, you know, the blind spots that I've also had. And, you know, my path is common in some ways. I did conventional medicine and then in my 30s found that it couldn't solve some of my health issues. And so I shifted more toward integrative medicine. And then I became obsessed with Jeff Bland and I started to learn about functional medicine. I've done all the training that IFM offers. And I think there's a way that just as we can criticize conventional medicine for being reductionistic, in some ways we do much the same with functional medicine and less so with integrative medicine. But, you know, in some ways I've heard people describe functional medicine as, yeah, instead of prescribing a medication, I get prescribed 14 supplements. So are we moving the ball forward? I think there's a reasonable question there. And then there's a lot of talk in integrative medicine and also functional medicine about the role of mind, body, spirit. And yet it's tricky to tend to it. You know, I feel like a lot of tending to mind, body, spirit is cultivating and empowering women, empowering people to do that for themselves. And I don't know a lot of clinicians that are really great at that.
Agreed. You know, I think, and I found myself in this, so go ahead. Sorry, finish your thought.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but one other thing that happens that I think is important, and it relates to what we're talking about with efficacy with therapy, is that there can be kind of this hypercognitive approach to taking care of the body. So in functional medicine, I think we see that, you know, anyone who's gone through Institute for Functional Medicine training, I don't mean to throw them under the bus, but you're like trying to drink from a fire hose. Like it is a massive amount of information. It's super cognitive. And yes, we're also paying attention to mind, body, spirit, but it's with this kind of obsessive, don't miss anything. Let's look at every single system, these seven systems, and now they create the matrix. And then I don't think a cognitive solution solves toxic stress and trauma. I don't think you can think your way out of it. But I interrupted you. So what were you trying to say?
No, I was just with regards to, I think, and I found this to be true for myself, you can quickly fall into over-testing and over-supplementing. And look, I believe in supplements. We have a supplements business. I take a lot of supplements, but I've also found myself in a position where, oh, wait, maybe I'm taking a little bit too much here. Maybe I need to. So I'm always trying to eliminate rather than add. And you can very quickly get in that over-testing. You know, you don't need to do extensive blood work maybe four times a year. Probably twice a year is all you need. Maybe once a year for some people. I think that's just important to note. Because are you really better off taking, you know, if I'm taking 40 capsules versus that are supplements versus pharmaceuticals, you know, I don't know. And I think it's becoming more and more nuanced. And the world between lifestyle modification and pharmaceutical intervention, whether that comes across in where someone's taking, you know, metformin or rapamycin for longevity, or perhaps, you know, Peter Attia is a big fan of statins to reduce CVD, or, you know, now GLP-1, or in the case of, you know, MDMA, I think these worlds are colliding where I think we're coming to the conclusion that, you know, maybe lifestyle can only get you 80% there or 70%. Everyone's got a different number. So like you could do all the therapy, do all the meditating, eat all the spinach, but you know what? You still have trauma and autoimmune, and maybe you need some extra help. And I think 10 years ago, if I were to think about our world, oh, there was a stigma around an intervention. Maybe not, you know, psilocybin. I think in our world, there was always kind of like, oh, it's all good. You know, don't get me started on marijuana. And our mutual friend, Andrew Huberman, has been very critical of marijuana usage for, I think, all the right reasons. But, you know, I think things are changing rapidly. We're becoming, at least I hope, becoming more open to both worlds, the Western med and pharmaceutical. Far from perfect, but there's some good there. There's a lot of nuance.
There is a lot of nuance. And I really appreciate you saying this towards the end of our conversation, because I think there's a personalization that has to happen. So when we've got blanket statements about okay, your LDL is this, or your ApoB is this, so you should take a statin. That's true across the board. We know that that's in precision medicine. You know, we know that you have to treat 25 to 50 people with a statin for one person to improve. And so understanding these nuances, understanding your pine network and how it's functioning, understanding, okay, spinach and meditation are only going to get you so far, and we need to fill this gap with something else. That's the way we want to proceed. Like, we want to be able to personalize in that way. And, you know, the other thing about psychedelic assisted therapy is that we're not talking about taking a supplement every day. We're not talking about taking a medication every day. It's a completely new paradigm where, in the case of MDMA, you might take it once every 8 weeks for three sessions and you're done. And the effects are durable for years. So we want to be open to the possibility of these other paradigms, but we also want to personalize.
Yes, well said. So we've covered a lot of ground today, other than I encourage everyone to pick up the book, The Autoimmune Cure. I'll hold it up for everybody watching on YouTube. Other than pick up the book, anything you would like to leave our audience with, maybe something we didn't cover, or perhaps some words of wisdom?
Well, I would say start with your ACE score. I want everyone to know what their ACE score is, because you may feel like you don't have much trauma from childhood, but unless you're actually measuring it and using some validated methods, you may not know how it might be living on in your body. So I would challenge our listeners, our beloved listeners, to do an ACE questionnaire. You can do it on my website at sarahgottfriedmd.com. You can just Google ACE questionnaire. It's available for free in the public domain. So I would say know your ACE score. Jason, do you know your ACE score?
No, I'm going to have to go do it now.
Yes, please. Can we put that in the show notes?
Well, my ACE, sure.
Mine's bad. Mine's like 6.
What, 6 out of what's the scale? What's the range? 6 out of 10 or 6 out of 100? Or
it depends on the questionnaire that's used, but generally 10. I use the IFM scale, which is a little bit higher.
Okay. So on your scale, that's 6 out of what?
So it's usually 10. It depends on, it's 10 for mine.
So 10 being the worst, 0 being the best in terms of trauma.
So 0 is considered normal, you know, kind of not exposed to trauma, although there are certain forms of trauma that are not tested by the ACE questionnaire, things like bullying. But yes, we know that a score of 1 or higher is associated with a greater risk of chronic disease.
Wow. I'm going to do the test.
Good.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Congrats on the book, and look forward to hanging out in Miami.
That sounds great, Jason. Thank you so much. Happy to be with you.